My name is Peter Hansen, and I'm the headmaster of Annapolis Christian Academy. And I'll talk to you a little bit more about my school as I go through the presentation. I think the best way, I just wanted to say I love the ACCS conferences. It's a real unique opportunity for all of us to network with one another, to hear great ideas, to share stories, and to give encouragement. And I must confess, I'm very nervous right now to be up here in front of all of you talking. I've never given this talk before, so this is a bit of an experiment. In all honesty, I feel very inadequate to be talking to you about leading a classical Christian academy. Most of you should probably be up here giving this speech, and I should be in your seat listening, trying to glean wisdom. The reality is that I have been a headmaster now for 4 years, and I'm 35 years old. So actually, I'm on my fifth year. So I became a headmaster at the age of 30, and I have been in the school of hard knocks for the last 5 years. And what I'm going to do is share with you postcards. I also realized that when I was putting together this presentation, there is way too much information here. Each one of the, if you look at the outline provided that I wrote up, seems like ages ago, and submitted, it was, each one of those sections can be its own talk and really needs to be. So what all I can attempt to do is give you little postcards of information about my experience in that department, whether it's board governance or, you know, whether it's management of faculty and staff or any of those other topics. So I hope you'll get something out of this talk. I enjoyed putting it together, and hopefully we'll have some time at the end here to be able to, I'd invite your feedback. I really would enjoy to hear your own experiences in these areas as we begin. So, what I wanted to do real quick was just introduce you a little bit to myself. I found this to be an apropos statement. It could be that the sole purpose of your life is to serve as a warning to others. And I feel that way in my own experience. So hopefully you will learn from some of the mistakes that I've made and some of the things that I've learned along the way. Well, that's me when I became headmaster of Annapolis Christian Academy. And the reality is that I never really wanted to be a headmaster. I really wanted to be a philosopher. And I read Plato's Republic when I was 15 years old. And I remember that central allegory of the cave image where we have these prisoners trapped in an underground cave staring at a wall of shadows. And in comes someone, a philosopher, and leads them out into the world of the forms, or the outside world, the world of truth, goodness, and beauty, the world of ultimate reality. That image captured me at a very young age, and that was what I wanted to do. I wanted to go on my journey of enlightenment. I wanted to be a philosopher. I wanted to dispense great truths to the world and discover all that there was to discover. And the reality, in retrospect, I really didn't have the intellectual guns to be a philosopher. And so I entitled this section of my talk really The Ambitions of an Intellectual Wannabe. My story is the story of, I think, many of you, a traditional track, if you will, towards the path of a headship. I went to Hillsdale College. I studied philosophy and I studied theology. And I remember something very important. It was a moment of a crisis. I think I was a sophomore, and my grandfather took me out to dinner. And he's a hard-bitten, hard-nosed, realist, pragmatist kind of guy. And I'm studying philosophy and theology, and you know he thinks I have just gone over the deep end. I'm paying like $30,000 a year to basically study to be unemployed, and. You know, he takes me out to dinner, and he sits me down for a steak dinner, top-notch filet mignon, delicious, and he says, "Peter, if you ever want to be able to enjoy one of these again, you better get a business degree." you know. And I went back to Hillsdale at that point with a sort of a crisis of faith, and you know, switched my major for one semester to marketing and business, and then you know, quickly determined that I needed to go back into philosophy and theology, which was my passion and my heart and where I wanted to be. So I am happy to say that that I am not unemployed, you know, many years after the fact. And I actually believe that in retrospect, my philosophical training, God used in my theological training, God has used tremendously in my life to prepare me for the work that I'm doing now. Well, I still wanted to be a philosopher out of college, and I couldn't get into any PhD programs. Like I said, I really didn't have the intellectual guns to truly do the work of hardcore academic philosophy. So I did the next best thing, and I applied for a Master of Arts of Liberal Arts at St. John's College in Annapolis. And that was a great experience for me. It taught me a lot. In my teaching years, I've taught at Regents. I began my teaching career teaching at Regents Classical School in Austin. I taught subjects like history and philosophy and political science and apologetics and logic and Latin and Bible and anything that I could get my hands on to teach, I wanted to teach. And I learned a great deal, and I made some lifelong friends there. I also had an opportunity to teach at Rockbridge Academy, which was formative for me. I got to see, again, a really top-notch classical academic program and be involved in that. And then I also was able to go back to Annapolis Christian Academy, where I had graduated from. I was initially hired back as their academic dean. I was then promoted to the secondary principal, and then in 2008, I landed the headmaster position. And so that's kind of my track, if you will. I think that's a traditional track. It's a good track for moving up into a headship and the responsibilities of that. I tell you a little bit about my school. My school is Annapolis Christian Academy. I just want to say we're in Corpus Christi, Texas. If you haven't been down there, it's a great city, but I really think it's on the frontier, if you will, of classical education. We're, I believe, the farthest south in America, the farthest classical school south in America, and with that comes some unique challenges. We're you know, a few hours from the border of Mexico, and so we have a large Hispanic population, a large Catholic population, and I just have to say, Corpus is, it's kind of a beach town, and you know, people like to wear cowboy boots or flip-flops. And classical education is not an animal that they understand or value necessarily. And so it's been a really unique experience trying to plant something like classical education in the soil, the sandy soil of Corpus, and watch it grow and thrive. It has become and evolved into its own monster, if you will. But this is my school right here. This is our new campus we built. As you can see, that big building in the building is my dream. That's not reality yet. But we do have a very good campus on a very small budget. And so I like to think of our school as, you know, big dreams, small budget. We have about 200 students in my school. And we need to be at about 250 to really be thriving and where we need to be in our strategic plan. We are accredited by the Association of Classical Christian Schools, which I highly recommend. If you haven't looked into that, I would encourage you as heads of your school, as leaders in your school, as boards of your school. I just believe that when it comes to classical Christian education, it's the creme de la creme. It represents the values and the things that we stand for and hold forth. And so I really believe that it's a valuable tool for you as a school leader to be allied with that organization. So that's my little plug for ACCS. I like to think of my job description as mission impossible. I remember when I first sort of saw the job description when I was secondary principal and becoming, you know, the headmaster, I was completely and utterly overwhelmed and thought there's no possible way I can do this job. There's just no way. I mean, basically, you know, if anything goes wrong in the school anywhere, you know, I'm the guy who takes the fall, right? And everything hinges. I'm responsible ultimately for every aspect of the school's operation. And that was an enormous challenge for me to get my head around that concept. I found this definition, I adapted it from the Devil's Dictionary for a headmaster. The headmaster is the greased pig in the field game of private education. And I can definitely feel that way sometimes. I also think that the headmaster is kind of that guy who's caught in the no man's land between parents, students, and board members, and faculty, and your larger sort of community. You're accountable to all of them. They all have radically diverse and different interests and demands. And you get fired at from all these directions at the same time. And it's really not a very enviable position to find yourself in, which makes me think that sometimes you know, to be a headmaster or a leader in classical Christian schools, you got to have a few screws loose. You got to be a little crazy to voluntarily take this position. And yet, I also think that being a headmaster is one of the most rewarding and challenging and interesting and fulfilling jobs. And I can't possibly imagine doing anything else with my career. And so it's one of those jobs that you both love and you hate. It's got enormous challenges associated with it, yet it is very rewarding work and exhausting work. Let me talk a little bit about governance. And let's see here. Some of the challenges that I faced when I became headmaster of my school. Initially, my first challenge was to get to know this diverse group of board members. At my school, they still had 3 or 4 founding board members when I came on as the headmaster, and that presented a number of unique challenges. Yesterday in the pre-administrative conference, they touched on this in the governance session. There are advantages and disadvantages to having permanent or, if you will, founding board members. I can just say that the greatest value is that they're the most invested in your school. They have been through so much, and they have usually put their finances on the line and their credibility on the line. They've stuck with the school through thick and the thin. And I will also say that's their greatest liability as well as board members, is that they are so heavily invested in the school and have a hard time letting go of and seeing change happen in the school. And so it presented a number of challenges in dealing with that. One of the initial questions that I wrestled with the board my first year as headmaster was, what was the function of a board, really, and what was this board going to look like, particularly after they had a difficult situation with the previous headmaster who had left because of some soured, bad relations that had developed with the board. And so the big item on the agenda was, how are we going to organize ourselves to prevent, you know, this from happening again, to make sure that there's a healthy relationship between the headmaster and the board. And so we debated and we researched, and I found myself getting into all kinds of literature involving boards that I had never encountered before. The first question was, well, we were a board of directors, and a board of directors is directly, and this was a question that was addressed in the pre-conference, and so I wanted to touch on this. A board of directors is really directly involved in the operation and the organization, really the management of the day-to-day operations of the school. How many of you, of your schools, have boards like that? If I can see a show of hands, a few of you probably, yes. Working boards, operationally minded boards. That's the way the board was when I came on, and really needed to be because I was so inexperienced as a leader in the school. at that level. But it's really the members of a board of directors are usually chosen for specific expertise that they can bring to the table, to the organization, and they are expected to exercise and utilize that expertise for the advancement of the school. There's usually a lot of standing committees on a board of directors, which is what we had. A number of standing committees, again, can be very helpful to a startup school. I think can be problematic as well as your school grows and ages. One of the things that we did was disband all of the standing board committees immediately. The reason being is because they tended to, that was the way in which they controlled, you know, the different aspects of the school that created the conflict with the headmaster before. There was a difference of vision, and the committees had control over a large part of the curriculum and the finances and all of this, and they were at odds with the headmaster at that time, and it created, obviously, an unworkable scenario for the board and the headmaster at that time. So one of the things we resolved to do was to disband all the standing committees and then create ad hoc committees as specific projects, you know, were needed, and so that gave us more flexibility with that. A board of trustees, I wanted to touch on the differences there. A board of trustees oversees the operation of the organization, but it's not directly involved in the day-to-day. It holds the mission and the operations of the school in trust. And it's kind of a hands-off board, whereas a board of directors is a very hands-on board. A board of trustees is a very hands-off board. They usually govern through policy making, and so you will hear trusteeship called policy boards and things like this. And in this way, board members are not burdened really with the day-to-day operations of the school, but they put their faith and their trust in the chief administrator, the headmaster that they hire. They don't function through direct control of the school. It's indirect control of the school through setting of policies, evaluations of the headmaster. Then there's really another sort of model for boards that we looked at, and it was the Carver model. And I'm just curious, how many of your schools are organized governance-wise using the Carver model? I see just one or two, a few. In many ways, I found this, going back to my you know, years studying Plato and my love of Plato, to be sort of the perfect form of governance, right? It was like the promised land. It was the most beautiful, intellectually satisfying way to organize a board. It was the perfect idea of governance. The reality that I found is that that ideal doesn't necessarily work in the real world, right? And so I think as an ideal, it's a very interesting model. I can tell you that it did not work for our school to move to a Carver model. It's sort of an extreme version of a policy board of trustees. The head has complete authority to operate the school, only limited by a certain number of limiting policies that the board will set. Otherwise, everything is the headmaster has absolute authority and absolute accountability. Both of those things really scared me. So I quickly went to the board and said, look, I don't want to do this. You know, I need your help. I need your oversight. I need your assistance as I grow in my role and my responsibility. So we kind of settled at, what did I do with my, here we go. We kind of ended up settling this first year with what we call a mission-directed strategic governance model in our school. It incorporates the best of the directorship or the hands-on board and the hands-off board, and it diminishes the dangers of each. I can give you more specific information about the ways that that works, but it's not the focus of my talk. Like I said, each of these topics, governance is a whole animal in and of itself, and we could spend hours talking about it. But the basic idea here is that the board is charged with accomplishing and advancing the mission in strategic ways. So it's directed, it's by the mission. It's a strategic focus, not a tactical focus, not a day-to-day operations focus. And it governs through policies, but also committees and helping of and direct oversight with the headmaster. So it's a hybrid model. I find it to be effective for us. So those are some of the different kinds of board models that we wrestled with and where we ended up landing in that first year. I want to talk a little bit to you about board savviness. What I found to be very important in my relationship with the board is that I know how to deal with them in appropriate ways. And I think part of the problem, I hear statistics somewhere that, you know, the average head of school lasts, between 3 and 5 years at a school. And that's really unfortunate given that it takes a good 10 years at an institution before you actually begin to see the effect of leadership on that school. And so what we've ended up having, because I think of unsavvy ways of interacting, of heads interacting with boards and boards interacting with heads, is this, you know, our schools are stagnant because of the lack of leadership stability that they've had. And so what we've done is my school is developed some guidelines for how this relationship is going to work. And so the first thing I would recommend to you is to celebrate strong board leadership and a close board head partnership. Now, here's the most important thing is this. The headmaster has to take the role of being captain of the strategic governing team. So you take and wear the captain hat. It's an awkward thing because they're your, if the board is your employer, right? You work for the board, essentially. Yet, you have to be the one leading the board with the chair, the president. But I want to submit to you that the chair and the president is, all board members are volunteer, you know, non-educational experts. They're experts in other areas. They're usually highly driven, motivated people, highly competent in other areas and things like this. But they aren't educational experts. They don't have the time to invest in knowing everything there is to know about a school. So they ought to give the captain hat to the headmaster, who needs to be the recognized leader of the board in significant ways. And I think that's an important point. But I think headmasters can tend to see boards sometimes as oppositional or as they don't welcome a strong board. It's like a zero-sum game, you know, where there's only so much power, right? And if the board has and exercises strong leadership, then it diminishes the headmaster. Or if the headmaster has all the power, then the board is very weak. I think that's not, get that out of your head. That's a bad model to work with. I think a strong head needs a strong board, and we ought to celebrate strong board leadership, lots of their involvement, and not fear that. You can kind of hear it sometimes in the way headmasters talk, and I don't know how to explain it other than just sort of illustrate it. You hear a headmaster, an unsavvy headmaster, say something like this: "You know, I stay out of the board's business, policy making. That's their business, and I stay out of that, right? And I expect them to stay out of my business, which is management and day-to-day, dealing with the operations of the school. I'm always aware of the danger that they'll become micromanagers over me and try to take over control rather than the governors that they're supposed to be. So I make sure to bring them finished staff plans. I make sure to keep them from digging too deeply into any of the information, so my reporting is only on specific things that I don't want them to ask questions about. You might kind of call me a border patrol officer. I'm always on the alert, keeping them from crossing over into my territory of operations, right? So I think that's an unsavvy approach to board leadership. But in my conversations with heads, sometimes that's what our conversation amounts to is you know, the board trying to figure out ways of keeping the board out of our business, right? I want to contrast that for you with what I think is a savvy approach to being a headmaster in their relationship with the board. And a savvy headmaster would sound something like this. One of my most important jobs is to make sure the board is fully deployed on behalf of my school. I see myself as the board's partner, sharing the work of governing. Of course, there must be some division of labor in areas such as planning, but frankly, you can't draw a hard and fast line between policy making on the one hand and management on the other. I've got to be an active participant in the job of governing, helping board members do and complete their fiduciary responsibilities as board members. I need to be helping them grow and educate them as board members and do all that I can to make sure that they find their work satisfying and fulfilling. So you can kind of see the difference between those two approaches, if you will, or attitudes, one savvy, one unsavvy. Another thing that I found is that it's important to devote about 20 to 25% of your time to governing and board issues. In other words, you need to invest a significant amount of time, researching board issues, compiling reports, giving boards full and accurate reporting on all the things that are going on in school. One of the things that I do is a weekly email, and it's a lengthy email. I send it to the board. I draw it up. Here's what's going on. Here's what's happened this week. So I don't let too much time go by where there's a lot of stuff building up and they have to hear all of it in one board meeting. That helps me keep my actual official board reports very short and succinct, because it's really only covering about one week of information or so. So constantly updating the board with information, I think, is very important. You got to see governance as a top priority for you. Spending 25 to 25% of your time doing things like developing agendas. It's very important that the board agenda, that you have an active involvement in setting that agenda. So I get together with the chairman of my board before our board meeting, and we go through all the things that we need to be doing, that the board ought to be doing, and we set that agenda together. And I recommend doing that. Other thing is, you need to help the board build its governing capacity. Become an expert yourself in the field of nonprofit governance. Regularly read periodicals. There's some really good stuff from Board Source that is helpful. Just study governance issues yourself so that you are the board's governance expert, right? And can be an effective leader for them in that way. You've got to see yourself as sort of the chief board developer. One of the things that I do to help develop my board is every week on the agenda, I put like an ISM article on board leadership, or I'll find a chapter and scan it and copy it and send it to the board for their development. So they're constantly discussing at every meeting issues of board development, improving, understanding their role as governors of the school. And I lead in that way, teaching them, educating them. It can be kind of a difficult thing. You got to make sure that you have a good relationship with your board where they trust you as that educator and see you that way. Also, I think another way that you can be savvy as a headmaster is to pay close attention to the psychological and the emotional facets of the relationship between the board and the head. The board tends to be ambitious, filled with ambitious people, hard-driving individuals. They can be impatient and at times imperious. They come to the boardroom with high expectations. They don't like to be disappointed. When you add to the mix all of the changing economy, the situation in your city, it can be relationships can fray fairly easily. And so pay close attention to the emotional facets of the head board relationship. A couple things that I do is employ two basic strategies for doing this. I take advantage of opportunities to provide the board members, I don't know a nice way to say it, but with ego satisfaction. I make sure that they're recognized, for their volunteerism, for their leadership. I make sure that in board communications that they have a presence, you know, or in school communications that they have a presence, they have a voice. I also want to try to help them develop more and more ownership of the school. And so I look for ways to do that, giving them speaking opportunities, as many as I can, to try to get them in front of our faculty and staff, make sure they're visible in the school community. So I look for opportunities for them, and I funnel them into those. And I think that helps, I don't know, like I said, it just sort of helps build that healthy, positive relationship with you and the board. I wanted to say just a few words about strategic planning. This was the first year, last year was the first year that I'd ever done anything like strategic planning, and I went and I got some training on how to do it. I recommend doing that or bringing in a consultant who can help you with developing a strategic plan with your board. I did the ISM training on strategic planning and strategic financial planning. I found that to be very effective and helpful for me. I would just about recommend any of ISM's training stuff. I found them to be very excellent in their training materials, but they are a bit pricey, so you have to budget for that professional development, for your own professional development, and make that a top priority. But I did find that this strategic planning is the most important aspect of the board's job. You need to make sure that they are talking about the strategic plan at every board meeting. It needs to always be on the agenda. In fact, it needs to be the focus of their agenda. And you need to direct them to the role that they play in helping execute the strategic plan. I think a five-year plan is a good thing. Along with that needs to come a financial plan. So if any strategic objective you have, like, oh, you want to get the, you want to add this program or anything like that, you have to have a financial cost associated with that so that you see the actual real cost of strategic initiatives, and you're able to plan for those in appropriate ways. We do an annual board retreat, a strategic planning retreat. We do it in July before, and we organize the board into committees based on the strategic plan and what we're supposed to be accomplishing that year. And the committee agendas for the board that year are basically driven by the strategic plan. So we look at our strategic plan, we're like, okay, what do we need to do to organize to accomplish this? What committees do we need? And then what is their agenda for the year and the deadlines for them to accomplish that? I have found it very hard sometimes to get committees to actually perform. And so this is why I think it's really important that they have a doable agenda that is accomplishable with deadlines, and then you have to lead the board and make sure that they're organizing their committees and getting and reaching those objectives. So strategic planning, very important. Let me talk for a few minutes about management. Some things that I found in my I got these principles from a book that I read. It was from Lehman and Pentac. It was principles about that are driven from this image of shepherding staff and that sort of thing. So it's biblical principles for staff management, and I found it pretty helpful, and I thought I'd just share some of the things with you, some of the principles. But the first thing I want to say is that I was really bad at what's considered what's called management by walking around, right? And I had to learn very early on that I had to get out of my desk, I had to get out of my books, and I had to get out from behind, you know, my safety zone, you know, where I was untouchable. And I have to be visible, and so I found that it's very important for heads to be visible at certain key points, because you still have a lot of work to do, right? And so you're still going to be at your desk a lot and behind your computer working on stuff. But if you can make yourself visible at key points of the day, it's really helpful. In the morning, first thing in the morning, greet everybody. You know, students, teachers, parents, be visible, be there. Just let your presence be there. And I'm a very productive person. I like to do things. And so it was hard for me to see my job as just being sort of around, you know, watching things and talking to people and building, you know, relationships. I'm like, but I need a task, you know, I want something to do, right? And the board had to tell me, no, this is what we want you to do, right? Just do nothing, be around, be visible. That's what we need you to do. So I found it to be important in the mornings, at lunchtime, that the students and the staff, when they're eating, that they see you. Just force yourself. You know, I like to think of it as planned neglect of all the things that are on my desk to do, right? I have to plan to neglect that stuff in order to pay attention to the stuff that matters, my visibility. At the end of school day, very important. That's the time when parents are most visible, most around the campus, and just listening to their conversations is very important. So visibility, management by walking around. I'm a self-confessed, you know, paper pusher. I would rather sit behind a desk. I'm very uncomfortable, and I had to learn to be sort of gregarious and outgoing and visible and available. Let me go through some of these principles real quick. The first principle of, I think, management that I found helpful is that you have to know the condition of your flock. And by this, I mean you need to make conscious efforts to follow the status of your staff members, as well as the status of their work. So not just their work, but their person. You need to follow them. You need to know what's going on in their personal lives. You need to know when they're having a bad day, and you need to be able to give words of encouragement and that sort of thing. So I think making a conscious effort to follow their status as well as their work, very important point. Also, you want to get to know your flock one member at a time. You want to make sure that you go out to lunch with them occasionally, individually, that you spend, that you pop into their classroom, that you have conversations with them one-on-one. You want to engage them on a regular basis as much as possible. You also have to keep your eyes and your ears open. You got to ask a lot of questions. And most importantly, you need to follow through with your conversations with them. Make sure that you don't drop the ball if you've said that you need to do something or to help them or to provide support for them. So those are important, I think, ways in which you can get to know your staff and follow them. Another principle is discovering the shape of your sheep. And this one is things like, it's an acronym, get to know the strengths of your faculty and your staff, the people that you're working with. Understand and play to those strengths. Find out what they're passionate about and what they're really good at and assign them those kinds of things. Other things are their heart. You know, each of your staff has a passion for something as well as strengths, and so get to know where their heart is. Also, their attitude. Very important that you understand the kinds of attitudes that are going on. Attitude is everything in many ways. Personality traits, you want to get to know them, as well as experiences and the different kinds of experiences that they have shaped their lives. So keeping in mind the shape of each of the individual people that work for you, very important for you to properly manage them and for you to properly place them in your organization. You also need to help your sheep identify with you, and by this I mean you need to put your mark on them. One of the things that if you look at shepherds, one of the things they'll do is, it's a fairly brutal practice, they'll basically brand these sheep. They'll clip their ears and put a tag on the sheep, and what they'll do is they'll get the sheep in, and they lull them in, and they sit down with them, and they cuddle up with them, and they make them safe and comfortable, and then they basically take this, you know, hole punch thing and punch a thing in their ear, and then those sheep are then identified as the sheep of so-and-so, right? Well, so it's a metaphor, but it's important that your flock, that your staff, your school as a whole look like you, Okay? That's, you are the school, the incarnate visible figure of what the school embodies. Okay? And so it's important that your school begin and that you be okay and comfortable with the school looking like you. If you're a board member, how many board members are here in the room? I'm just kind of curious. There's a lot of board members. This is what you want to hire your headmaster for. You want someone that you see the qualities of your school that you want to embody, right? And that's the person that you want to lead the school. It was actually one of the greatest compliments I ever received. It was after my first year as headmaster, and one of the faculty came up to me and was like, you know, the school just, it just is different. And I was asking, well, what, you know, what's different about it? And they're like, well, it just feels a lot different this year, and it looks different. It looks like you, you know. And at the time, I didn't know if that was a compliment or, you know, not. But in retrospect, I was very grateful to hear that and thankful to hear that. That's what should be happening. You should be leaving your mark on the school in visible and tangible ways, on your staff as well, shaping them by your person, by your example. And so some ways to do this, infuse every staff member with a sense of importance. You need to model authenticity. You need to model integrity. You need to model compassion. You need to relentlessly communicate your values and your mission to your school and everything you're doing in your meetings and your communications. You're always communicating your values and your mission. And then also remember that great leadership is personal. You need to have a personal relationship with people to leave your mark on them. All right. Another principle involves the physical place of business, your pasture, if you will. Make sure that it's safe. And by this, I mean you need to keep staff well informed. When they feel like they're not knowing what's going on, it creates all kinds of problems in your organization. So keeping your staff well informed. Now, you can't tell them everything, but you've got to tell them what you can tell them and tell them clearly. And can, you know, it's important that your staff, because they're the ones, if they're blindsided with a question, hey, why did so-and-so, have this problem or something like that, and they don't know the answer, then they feel immediately nervous and uncomfortable. So it's very important that that they're well informed. Also, you need to infuse every member with a sense of importance. You need to make sure that even your janitor knows that how valuable his job is in maintaining the beauty that the school is committed to. Right? You need to make sure that every member of your staff, no matter how menial the task, knows that they are very, very important to the organization. They need to know it. They need to feel it. Public praise is very, very important function for the headmaster. But you also need to make sure that if there are instigators and malcontents, that you call those from the flock. And it only takes a couple bad attitudes to really ruin it for everybody, you know. And so you need to identify and deal with the instigators, the gossipers, the malcontents, and you need to be proactive about doing that, not reactive. And so calling them, basically, you know, removal and or just dealing with that issue, making sure that it's safe. It's a safe place for everybody to work. Also, regularly rotate students to, that should be staff, to fresh pastures. People get locked into, you know, one job. And it's really good idea to try to, you know, create diversity, give people new assignments, new teaching assignments, new tasks to do so that they don't burn out, and, you know, in the area that they're working in. And also, don't give problems time to fester. If there is a problem and you know about it, be direct. Go to the person, deal with the problem. Festering problems create an unsafe work environment for everybody. Okay. Another issue involves the another principle here involves the staff of direction. If you look at shepherds, they carry one of those staves, and that is provided for. That is a necessary tool for directing and for giving direction. So you got to know where you're going. You need to be able to get out in front of your staff. You need to be able to have a plan and a direction, and you need to be able to keep them on the move, keep people moving in the right direction. When you're directing and when you're leading, you need to use persuasion rather than coercion, although coercion is a tool on the table at times, but persuasion is always the most effective way to lead. And give your staff freedom of movement, but make sure they know where the fence line is. They need boundaries, not bridles. You don't want to necessarily, you know, control or micromanage them, but you definitely need to be able to provide the clear boundaries so they know where the fence line is and where they, and then give them freedom, true freedom of motion and movement within those boundaries. And then when staff are in trouble and you know it, it's your job to go and get them out and get them into safety. And by that, you know, it could be a parent problem. It could be, a personal problem. It could be a train wreck waiting to happen. You dare not neglect that. You need to make sure that when your staff are in trouble, that you are there to help get them out of trouble. It's your job and your responsibility to do that. Also, failure isn't fatal, and your staff need to know that it's okay to fail. Everybody is going to fail, and so it's not the worst thing in the world to try something and to not succeed at it. And so you need to provide an environment where they're free to fail, you know, without fear of losing their job or their position and things like that. In fact, you want to encourage risk-taking that is an acceptable level of risk, right? Not too much risk-taking, but it's very important that they know that their failure is not going to cost them their job. Also, the rod of correction. This is a tool that a shepherd would use. It was basically a big stick, and he would throw it at sheep to correct them if they were fixing to go off into danger in some way, right? And so this can be an important part of managing like a shepherd. Discipline, when you have to discipline a staff member, use it as a teaching opportunity, right? And make sure that it's not just a punitive action, but that it's an opportunity for the staff to grow, to learn, and that they and then you can become the teacher in that role. Also, you need to regularly inspect their progress and make sure that staff are making progress in their plan, in their development plan, in their personal goals, and that sort of thing. If you use the rod too much, or if you use the rod incorrectly, you'll lose the goodwill of your staff. And that's true. I've had instances where I've, made mistakes, you know, overreacted and it's been difficult. It's created difficulties with my staff. And I've had to repent several times for misusing this important tool. But it's a tool that must be used. Discipline must be tight in your organization and expected at times. Also, cultivating the heart of a shepherd, this is the most important part. A great leadership is a lifestyle. It's not a technique. It's not just a series of practices that you put into place. It's how you are. It's how you live. Also, every day you have to decide who's going to pay for your leadership. It's either going to be you or your staff are going to pay for your leadership. And it's very important that you be a true shepherd and not a hireling. Jesus talked about the true shepherd. I am the true shepherd. And the hireling is just a hired person. They don't have the heart for the people. And so that's the most important aspect, is that you develop a real heart for the people that work with you, that work for you, and that you're not just, that you have their best interests in mind. So those are some core principles, seven, if you will, principles of management that I found effective. What I want to talk about now is educational leadership. I need to be careful of my time here, so I'm just going to... Okay. One of the ways that you can lead your school is by being the academic leader, by being the educational leader. And heads of school, they have to be academics first and foremost, I believe. Not primarily administrators, not primarily fundraisers or CEOs or figureheads or glorified scoutmasters or group leaders or community organizers. Essentially, you have to remember you are leading an academic community, and you must become an academic if you're not, or seek to always be a better academic. It's essential that the head understands the purpose of an academy, and that he helps fulfill the purpose by hitting the bullseye all the time with respect to offering a high quality, excellent educational experience for students. I myself use the term headmaster intentionally rather than head of school because I like to identify myself as the head faculty member, right? I'm the lead teacher of the academy, even though I don't teach that much. And I do think it is healthy for a head of school to teach, although it is often difficult given the demands of time. But I recommend if you can make time for a high school elective or something like that to do that, because it's important that you not lose touch with your role as a teacher. But really, more than anything else, as the leader, as the headmaster, I have found myself to be my classroom and my students are the teachers. I am now a teacher of teachers, and that's my primary class, my primary constituency. So what I've done is I've developed what's called the faculty seminar model. This is a way in which I engage academically with my teachers throughout the year. The faculty seminar meets biweekly, every 2 weeks, and it's run like a seminar, like a college seminar class. We meet for 1 hour every other week. I meet with the grammar school teachers separately from the secondary school teachers because we're both reading the same materials, but they have very different needs, concerns, areas of interest, and pedagogy styles that it's helpful to meet with them separately as groups. I pick books, and we read great books together. We've read a lot of things. Plato's Republic was one of my favorites, and taking my faculty through Plato's Republic, very engaging. It is Socratic style. I ask questions. I engage them Socratically. So we're teaching and modeling the Socratic method for our teachers, our grammar teachers as well. They really need that because they don't get as much of that in their teaching experience, and so it's healthy for them to engage in that sort of thing. This is one of my favorite quotes from Socrates. It's sort of the model, the mission of the faculty seminar. This is Socrates. He says, it's from the Laches. Every one of us should seek out the best teacher whom he can find, first for ourselves, who are greatly in need of one, and then for the youth, regardless of expense. But I cannot advise that we remain as we are. And if anyone laughs at us for going to school at our age, I would quote to them the authority of Homer, who says that modesty is not good for a needy man. Let us then, regardless of what may be said of us, make the education of the youths our own education. So this faculty seminar model that I've developed is an ongoing professional development, adult learning experience. It is a class. We read through classic works. We read through educational philosophy. We talk about it, we develop, we sharpen each other, and essentially it's a way for me to teach the teachers on an ongoing basis. So I recommend doing something like that with your teachers. It's just important that they see you as the true educational leader, as their educational leader. Also, I wanted to comment on something. How many of you have read through or are familiar with the CARDIS survey that came out recently? Just a few of you, okay. I would recommend getting a hold of this. You can just look it up, just Google it, and read through it. It's a very important survey that was conducted. Really, I think one of the only ones of its kind. It basically, it was conducted by Canadian Foundation, and it probed the reactions of Christian school alumni from ages 23 to 39 about three things: their spiritual formation, their cultural and community engagement, and their academic development. But it was about midway through the report that we learned from a sort of representative group of headmasters who were polled about their institutions and what their priorities were with respect to their schools. And the answers that were given by most of the participating heads of the Protestant schools that were surveyed, they made no mention of academic intentions as their top priorities for their schools. The number one thing, overwhelmingly, for these headmasters was spiritual formation, biblical worldview, and relationship with God. These were the most important, if you will, priorities of their school. And I think rightfully so. How many of you get the Paideia letter? Bruce Lockerbie puts out a letter. It's a really great, he responded very well to this, I thought, and was really alarmed at the lack of academic priorities set by the headmasters. Instead, he sort of likened them to, you know, glorified youth leaders. Our schools, he said, our Christian schools are just becoming not institutions of academic excellence, but really just touchy-feely youth group activities. And so he was very concerned about that, and he, I think I have a quote here for it. No, I do not. Okay. But the report itself says this: many stakeholders in Protestant Christian schools hesitate to focus too much on academics, fearing that in the process schools will lose their distinctive commitment to faith development. That's a really important point. It's a fallacy to think that to have high academics, you have to compromise your faith commitment, right? Or that to have a strong faith commitment, you've got to water down your curriculum. And I think as educational leaders of your schools, it's really important that you communicate very clearly your number one, you exist as an academic institution to provide an education. It is in the context of a biblical worldview, and you, of course, hope that your students will develop strong relationships with God and things like that. But ultimately, those aren't the things that you can provide or have control over. The things that you need to focus on are providing the highest quality academics for your students, for their families, within the context of a biblical world and life view. You know, but you exist as an academic institution, not a youth group. So it's important, I think, that we do what we can as classical schools to sort of change the direction of Christian education or what it has been in the past. I think I'm pretty much out of time. I wanted to leave a few minutes for any questions. I didn't get through really a whole lot of the information that I wanted to today, but I hope I was able to share some things that were maybe of value to you. At this point, I just kind of want to open it up and see if anybody has any comments or questions about anything really relating to educational leadership, being a leader, a headmaster, or a board member, or anything like that. Yes, I actually had a whole presentation on principles of sustainable budgeting. And there are some key ideas in there that I think are really important for headmasters to, first of all, you need to get good financial training. That was what I found, because I had no financial training. When I came on board, the first thing I had to do was go to school big time on the finances. I went from, you know, managing my household income to managing a $1.5 million budget, and I learned very quickly that I was out of my league. And so I think going and investing in financial training is very, very important. I think sustainable budgeting is the first thing is you need to develop budgets 3 years out, right? You need to look at doing so that you can see the impact of your decisions today 3 years down the road. 3 years down the road is feasible. You can look down that far. And so I think that's an important principle to keep in mind. I also think, you know, cost-based tuition, hard income coverage, trying to get there in your school is a very important principle. We are not there. In my school, I still have 10% of my budget that's fundraised. That's not ideal. I think that's not a sustainable way. It puts your school at risk operationally. And I think that is, as soon as you can, try to move your school to a cost-based tuition model. And if you have limited markets where your tuition can't go above a certain rate, then you need to look at boosting your enrollment to get to that point, right? So, because your income has to come from two sources, enrollment, hard income has to come from enrollment or tuition, right? And so you need to study and be, and know what your market is for your tuition rates to set them appropriately. And then you also need to look at what business model, what your school needs to be in order to pay for the salaries and the facilities and all of those expenses. Bottom line, there is no cheap way to run a quality Christian school. Amen? You cannot do it. And your parents need to understand that. It cannot be done. Quality education is expensive no matter how you cut the pie or slice the pie, right? I think things like being meticulously honest about your costs, I found to be a very difficult thing. You need to make sure that you understand all the money you're giving away in discounts, that you account for every single one of those pennies. And the other principle here is if you watch your pennies, your dollars are going to take care of themselves. So you've got to be, I sign every check that is written in the school. I see every expense that is made in the school. I watch it carefully. There's a purchase order form that has to be signed by two people if we buy anything. So watching the expenses and making sure that this is a good expense, a necessary expense, and watching that very carefully is, I think, an important step there. I think also you need to make sure that you are building reserves. I have found that having reserves for a rainy day, we lost about 75 students. We had a 30% attrition rate last year as a result of some factors in the school. And had we not had a reserve system in place, ISM recommends about 20% of your operating budget. I think that's a very important thing to have because we live in a volatile economic time and things can happen and your school can be at risk for going under if you don't have enough income to float through those bad years. Yes, sir.
I disagree with your statement that first and foremost, the headmaster needs to get in.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that statement. I think it's just one of priorities. I think I would rather have, and this is, I guess, maybe just my own bias or personal preference. I think if I'm looking at a school, I want to make sure that the figurehead, the headmaster, is educationally minded first. He's someone who knows education, has taught, someone who understands teaching, learning, because that's what the business of the school is all about. I would hire, a development director to raise funds, or I would look to the board for doing that. I do think, the headmaster has to be involved in all of that stuff, but I think being a CEO, being an organizer, those are all good things, to have. I just would place the academic, and I agree with your statement. All of those things skills are necessary for a good headmaster, but I think the academic one can't be neglected. I think it's very important. Yes, sir. Yeah.
And then in terms of the financial piece, through ISM, you referenced that there was NAIS, National Association of Independent Schools, there are a number of sustainability markets. Mm-hmm. They can be
Yeah. Yeah, one of the things on that financial thing that we found was we were giving away so much money in discounts to people who we were subsidizing who could easily afford the school that it was taking away from our ability to fill seats for people who needed the money or needed the income, the tuition help. So we did move to a complete need-based tuition. We phased out over 2 years all faculty, staff discounts, pastoral discounts, and moved to a strict need-based system. Now, we do have, though, our faculty and staff can get up to 100% of their tuition paid for if they qualify for it, right? So everything goes on a need basis, though, and we found that to be an effective way of targeting the dollars spent on tuition assistance to the people who need it the most. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, communication, I think, is such an important skill as for a headmaster. One of the ways that I do it, I do what's called a Warrior Weekly. Our Warriors are our mascot, right? And so I do an email communication, and I talk to our parents, our constituents, our students, our donors every week. It's like a blog, right? And it goes out, it emails to all of them. It's more than just what's going on in the school this week. It is targeted to build value in the school that that their kids, their grandkids are attending. I talk, like the last one that I did was like, do you have enough classical education to appreciate the Hunger Games, right? Because everyone in our school is reading the Hunger Games, right? And the movie came out and it's this blockbuster. And so classical education speaks to so much in our culture, right? And so I wanted to connect, you know, the value of what we're teaching with what's going on in our culture. And so I'm doing that constantly with our families so that we're communicating clearly the value of the school over time, constantly reminding our parents. It's so easy to forget if it's not before them. And so I think there's lots of ways to communicate. I do a hard copy one. It's called the Warrior Word, as opposed to the Warrior Weekly. And this comes out in the fall and in the spring. And it's a print publication. I try to highlight alumni. I try to highlight things that are going on with our capital improvements and capital campaigns. And try to, it's slick. It's professionally produced. I highly recommend investing in that. It does cost some money, to put that out. I mail it out to everybody. There's something to be said for having a hard copy, getting in the mail, and whether they read it or not, I don't know, but I see it as a valuable communication tool for our constituents, our families. So, any other questions? Comments? Okay. Well, thank you guys so much for, hope I didn't put you to sleep. I know it's that time of day.